Sometimes the most meaningful work we do begins by just saying yes. Inspiration comes from many places, dreams, accidents, epiphanies, but it can also come from something much simpler, a deadline. When he was asked which came first, the music or the lyrics, the songwriter Sammy Kahn said, "The check." For him, the gig was the muse. Breakthroughs come in all kinds of containers, and often they come because they're needed to get the job done. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Last September, my dad, Ben, and I played a concert at Taliesin in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Taliesin was Frank Lloyd Wright's home and studio, an 800-acre estate in the hills of southwestern Wisconsin that stands as one of the purest expressions of Wright's prairie school architecture. Our show took place at the Hillside Theater. It's a space that for decades served both Wright's architectural fellowship and the surrounding community. Students gathered there, neighbors came. It hosted plays, films, lectures, and lots of music. Ben and I had been asked to create some kind of a special program for the event, so I just kind of freestyled an idea and sent it to the organizers. I said in an email, "If, as Goethe wrote, architecture can be seen as frozen music, perhaps music can be seen as architecture thawed." Join father and son Ben and Leo Sidran as they explore what that might mean and put it into practice on stage. I thought it was highbrow enough to sound like we knew what we were doing and vague enough to give us room to improvise. After I signed the contract, I got around to telling my dad what we had agreed to do. But fortunately, this is exactly the kind of thing he handles well. In fact, I had a memory of once seeing him give a lecture at Taliesin, riffing on some of these same ideas when I was a kid. But as the event approached, Ben and I found ourselves diving deeper and deeper into this conversation. We were talking about the parallels between architecture and music, about overtones and the harmonic series, about patterns and shapes, systems of organization that appear again and again in nature. We didn't create any kind of formal lecture, but we talked about it so much that we started to think we understood it. Our plan was to continue that conversation on stage and see what happened. Ben organized the musical side of the program around variations of the blues. His idea was that just as architecture can be built from simple structural units, squares, rectangles, repeating forms, music can also be built from simple structures that allow infinite variation. So we started the show with Ben's blues, Swing State. And in between songs, we talked.
How is music similar or comparable to Frank Lloyd Wright's concept of unit structures? And Frank Lloyd Wright had this whole set of perceptions to translate natural forms into his architectural drawings.
As we started to debate and discuss and talk about what we were going to do, you came up with, a really clever approach to talk about, especially jazz, as a kind of parallel, which is to look at variations on the blues. Because the blues is built on a few very simple structural elements.
Just as Frank Lloyd Wright's work is based on very simple structural elements, squares, rectangles, hexagons. There's a repetition in it, there's a form to it, but within that, there's a kind of natural freedom. And if you can see in the graphic of the curtain, how amazing it can be to take these simple elements and use them as a kind of grammar, a physical grammar, or in our case, an audible grammar.
So we open tonight with your song, Swing State.
Swing State.
Which I thought was a perfect song to open with, not only because it's a very simple blues, but because it's dedicated to Wisconsin.
Right.
The swingingest state
swing
there is.
State. That's right.
The thing is that by the time we got to that show, Ben and I had been talking about these ideas for months. Meanwhile, the audience had just dropped in for an evening out. And pretty quickly, our program drifted into the realm of the questionably digestible.
Like music, reality is based on waves, on vibrations. From the smallest electrons to the largest, the universe, everything is vibrating. It is literally singing. In fact, electrons don't exist as matter. They exist as vibrations. They don't become matter until we experience them.
Still, we felt pretty good about ourselves afterwards. We drove home satisfied that we had done something meaningful and instructive. People seemed to enjoy it, especially this one guy who kept clapping. A few months later, Ben got a call from the Palm Springs International Jazz Festival. They asked him to create a program, a lecture with music, about jazz and modernism. Palm Springs has become a pilgrimage site for fans of mid-century architecture. Every February, thousands of people descend on the desert to tour the glass houses and low-slung pavilions designed by architects like Richard Neutra and Albert Frey. The jazz festival takes place right in the middle of it. Ben agreed to do the gig, confident that after our Taliesin experiment, he could put something together easily. I was booked to join him along with our friend and longtime co-conspirator bassist Billy Peterson. And then Ben sat down to watch the video of our Spring Green performance, and he realized something. What we remembered doing and what we had actually done were not exactly the same thing. And that realization sent him into a bit of a tailspin. My father still has one of the most remarkable minds of anyone I know. But he is now 82 years old, and projects like this take their toll in ways they never used to. My parents spend half of the year in Palm Springs, and they have a lot of friends there now. Apparently, everyone they knew in town was planning to attend the show, so the stakes for my dad had suddenly become social as well as creative. I showed up in Palm Springs a few days before the concert, and I found my father sitting at the piano in the shadow of an unmoving mountain, surrounded by months of notes, trying to wrestle the ideas into some kind of order.
So, tell me how we got here.
Oh, God. 4 or 5 months ago, when we did the Taliesin thing, I had already by then done 2 months of trying to figure out how you can talk about jazz and architecture, and this whole idea of rhythm and vibration, I thought, well, this is it. Vibration in string vibration and harmonics and how they buttress each other and how you improvise with pieces that really aren't there. They are there, but anyway, when I heard the playback of the Taliesin thing, I didn't like it at all. It was way too technical. And it was grasping at how do I talk about building in music in a way that would complement what Frank Lloyd Wright was talking about when he talked about frozen music. And the last 4 months, man, I've been reading and, well, here, to do this, I have to go to my computer.
Okay.
These are just some of the files. This is 4 months of going down the rabbit hole. For example, here's a whole file on the Fibonacci system, Fibonacci and jazz. Because I was going to talk about the 2-5-1 harmonic proportion system of jazz and relate it to the Fibonacci sequence. The Fibonacci sequence is really nothing to do with 2-5-1 harmonics because it's not a simple proportion, like 2-5-1, if A is 440 and the octave above is 880, and then the Fibonacci system is quite simply to take a number, take 1. 1 plus 1 is 2. 2 plus 1 is 3. 3 plus 2 is 5. 5 plus 3 is 8. 8 plus 5 is 13, and it goes and goes and goes, and it all those numbers divide into what they call the golden mean, which is 1.6. I mean, you see where I'm going? It's like crazy, and I was trying to adjust these things so that we could talk about the 2-5-1.
Does the overtone series not somehow align with the Fibonacci sequence? The way a string vibrates or a sound wave vibrates, the octave and the fifth, do those not align with the Fibonacci sequence?
No, there's not directly aligned with it.
But they share a deep mathematical and musical connection regarding natural frequency ratios. While the harmonic series is a linear...
is a linear arithmetic series. The Fibonacci sequence approximates the golden ratio, which often appears in harmonic or natural musical intervals. Okay.
Okay.
So maybe it does. So maybe I was onto something, but there was no way I could express it or put it out there where people could. I mean, I still think that this is the dissertation. This is the subject.
Sure. And this is, I mean, Gil Goldstein, Howard Levy, Jacob Collier have all talked about it in the interviews.
Well, better than me, because these are geniuses, and I can't get there. But you can imagine how much time I spent on trying to get there.
Indeed, listening to my dad try to make sense of these ideas reminded me of the conversations I had years earlier with musicians who thought deeply about the same questions. The arranger and pianist Gil Goldstein once described the Overtone series to me as a guiding principle, a kind of natural blueprint for how music resonates.
Okay, we have the musical language. It's really mathematical, and we can look at pitches as individual numbers. A half step is one, a whole step is two, minor third is three. We can look at rhythms as numbers. 1-1-2, 1-1-3. You have infinite combinations of mathematical permutations that can develop musical ideas. You don't have to go back to boring things that we've heard a million times. And also for harmony, that you can generate it like, you know, here's a chord of these numbers stacked up. Now, everybody, you know, got their panties in an uproar because, oh, this is anti-intuitive. But I never thought of it as that. I thought it was like you look for a combination that excites you, and then you apply your intuition to it. In nature, and this is one of the things I like, you can kind of see the way a melody behaves. And you could say, well, gee, look at this melody. It's all going down. It's probably a little sadder. And the heroic one might go up. And then there's natural growth patterns, like in pine cones and seashells, based on number series, so you can actually detect that in a melody and see proportions that relate to these natural series. And they've found that in a lot of the shapes that Bach intuitively wrote, you know, the height of the section comes at the Fibonacci number that divides it in the golden mean. And then modern composers like Bartók said, well, let's say if I start with that and, you know, map it out and I'm going to be guaranteed to do it, it's a little harder to get there like that. But some of his pieces were based on that, and he would use numbers from those series that would try to guarantee a natural thing.
Right. And how do you use it now in your arranging?
Well, you know, it just made me aware of the vast possibilities. The Overtone series is our teacher of how things resonate in nature, and you have to be aware of it. I hate to say it like in a religious way, but you have to take it like a sort of a Ten Commandments and a, like, I believe in the Overtone series, that it's very, you know, there's something that if you can recreate some quality that resonates, it's not cluttered, music will sound good and be understandable, and people will go, I'm resonating with that, and there's something in it. I can't completely analyze it, just like I can't analyze why the melody yesterday is organic, you know, but there's certain things that great things have that I think go back to some source of the Overtone series and something about these organic numbers that we're dealing with. And I'm always in search of that.
Everybody has their own ear. Everybody has their own thing that they hear and the way they hear it. You know, you have it. We all hear melody. We all could write songs potentially. Right. I think if you're in a room with five people, it's possible they'll all hear the same thing, but it's also very likely that they'll all hear some variation on something.
Right.
The idea that there's something sort of primal in all of us that is trying to reach into pre-existing series in nature, it's kind of interesting.
Well, everyone has a universal musical mind, and that's what we're trying to contact in ourselves. And when we do, then people respond to it because they recognize it. It's not coming from your brain. It's coming, your choices are they're so organic that you know, you almost don't have a choice. Your soul tells you, this is the next phrase, you know, and this is the shape. and you put it at this relationship to the pulse. And I think as you do that, you're becoming intuitive and you're somehow tuning in to what nature tells us from the Overtone series. Mm-hmm. I know it's a bit of a jump, but I believe that it's could be true. The history of music has followed the path of the Overtone series. Like an octave was the first accepted consonance in every culture. And we, you know, it's like the distance between a male and a female voice. If it's kind of the natural thing, and every scales has an octave is the frame, and then it moved to a fifth, mm-hmm. and the fifth started to, I mean, in Western music, generate Gregorian chant, mm-hmm. but then as we started to experiment, the fifth, an octave doesn't give you other choices because an octave doubles itself and goes to infinity, but the same note. A fifth goes C, G, D, A, and then we have the major scale right there in the fifth, mm-hmm. and the major scale with the sharp fourth as it goes up. So to me, that's kind of how things unfolded historically, and it's a fact. Every culture had their different spin on a fifth and an octave, but it's still the same material, more or less. Mm-hmm. So it also means that an octave is 2-to-1. A pitch is twice the fundamental. A fifth is 3-to-2. And those are, that's our unfolding of rhythm. But unfortunately, historically, we haven't unfolded rhythmically as quick as the pitch component. Because if you write 4-against-3 and present it to an orchestra, they might stumble a little. And I've had that happen to me. And that's a fourth, you know. And everybody knows what a fourth sounds like and can reproduce that sound. And that's very basic. But 4-against-3 is not so easy, and 5-against-3 is harder, and 5-against-4, and as we go up, it almost becomes impossible for modern musicians to do that. Modern composers are writing it, but it still sounds very remote, mm-hmm. and like, oh, geez.
Another musician who had spent years exploring these ideas is the virtuoso harmonica and piano player Howard Levy. When I spoke with him for the third story back in 2015, he described how rhythm and pitch are actually expressions of the same relationships, just unfolding at different speeds.
So I said to myself, what instead of having a 12-tone octave, what about a bar of 12 beats? How about 12/8, just for the hell of it? So now we have 12 eighth notes of what would be the rhythmic thing as equivalent to 5x plus 2y in rhythm. Would be X being a quarter note and Y being an eighth note. 5 quarter notes plus 2 eighth notes equal 12/8. So I said, just for curiosity, I wonder what the rhythmic equivalent of the major scale is. Mm. So it's whole, whole, half, whole, 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 half. Now it's going to be quarter, quarter, eighth, quarter, 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 eighth. And that sounds like this. That's like the main bell pattern in Afro-Cuban music and triple time meter. Then I realized you got the Dorian rhythmic. The rhythmic Dorian mode of this would be. And the Phrygian mode would be. The Lydian mode is. All of these things are in like Afro-Cuban and Afro-Brazilian music. So basically, cultures that are more rhythmically based are using the same formula for the rhythmic basis of their music mm. as the cultures that are pitch based. And it's all numbers. They're whole numbers, and it's also based on the whole number relationships of the natural overtone series, which gets into other things. This absolutely blew my mind for me to be able to put into actual structured form something that I had felt years before listening to Afro-Cuban music was an incredible personal epiphany for me. I worked on the various nuances and extensions of that for the last like 15, 20 years.
If you don't mind talking just briefly about how this relates to the Overtone series, I'm curious.
Oh, yeah, the Overtone series. Well, every string and column of air that's not asymmetrical is resonating to various different frequencies, because like if a string, one string vibrating at its whole length, half its length, a third of its length, a fourth of its length, a fifth, a sixth, the seventh, on up to infinity. And so if you just hold down a low note just on the piano without playing it, the damper's up. So I'm going to play the harmonics. This is an octifier. It rings on the string.
Yeah.
And then this is a fifth higher than that. It rings on the string, and then they're all ringing on that string. I started thinking about what would the rhythmic equivalent of this be? And a bunch of other people have thought about this before me and after I thought about it. The intervals that we play before you get into tempering them to get the tempered 12-tone octave, they are based on pure ratios. The fifth, which is generated from the interaction between the first two harmonics, so is a ratio of 3-2 in vibrations. The fourth is a ratio of 4-3 in vibrations. The major third is a ratio of 5-4. The minor third is 6-5. And then this other minor third is smaller. In the non-tempered world, that flat seventh is actually flatter. And then you get into 9-8 and 15-16 and all these other. So I thought in rhythm, 3-2, it's a polyrhythm. If you take this thing, a 220 and then a fifth above, in the non-tempered world would be 3-330. You slow it down 100 times, you get the polyrhythm of 3 against 2. The fourth, which would be 330 to 440, which is 4 against 3, is, you know, 3 against 4. And then you get the major third, which would be, I can't remember which, let's say 440 to 550 or something like that. So, which is very much like a Fravo, which is sort of a tempered version of 5 against 4. You start looking at everything numerically and mathematically, it gets really, really interesting. And so polyrhythms and intervals are the same things at different speeds. So this also blew my mind when I started realizing this, you know. And then if you get to the frequencies above pitch, you start getting into light. It's interestingly enough, if you take white light and split it up with a prism, you get 7 colors. So we have like 7 note scales all over the world, really, really common. And we have these 7 note rhythmic patterns, you know. So there's numbers that keep coinciding in the super fast vibrational speeds of light, the middle speed of pitch, and the lower speed of rhythm. And then even below rhythm, where like rhythm is related to body movement. If it's slower than the speed of your walking, it's hard to feel it. Then it starts getting into time, which is more abstract. You have to count it. And then you need a watch. And coincidentally, that has 12 numbers on the dial. And then if it's slower than a watch, you need a calendar, which coincidentally has 12 months. And the weeks are divided into, there's weeks of 7 days. And they have 5 weekdays and 2 weekend days, which on most people's calendars, the weekend days are half the size to make them fit on one line for non-musicians who don't work on Saturdays and Sundays. So I find this like fascinating, that these numbers just keep reoccurring. Yeah, I'm not making this up. 5 and 2, 7, 12. It just keeps reoccurring through all of these different things. It's not mysticism or anything. It's empirical.
No, but it's interesting when you started to talk about the vibrations of the overtone series and you said, this is why scientists become religious sometimes.
Yeah.
It does sort of speak to this thing that I think some of us feel without being able to articulate, which is whether or not you're composing or improvising or just playing, there are those moments when the music sort of feels inevitable and you do open yourself up as a channel to it.
Yeah.
And we don't know what to call that, but it may be that we are literally a vessel for these naturally occurring things. Yes. And we're just tapping into them.
Man, I agree 100% that it's bigger than we are. We're just dipping into the stream. Yeah.
When I first met Jacob Collier, he was just 19 years old, just before he exploded onto the global scene. But even then, he was fascinated by the physical sensation of resonance, the moment when a chord suddenly locks into place.
And I found like that sometimes if you sang a major chord, it didn't sound in tune on the piano. But then if you just sang it, it sounded in tune. And I've sort of learned about just intonation post that time and know about the third being a bit lower and how that's the sort of natural place in the harmonic series, and then harmony sounds good for real. And that's something I'd really try and do to this day, to get things in tune. But I discovered how it felt to sing a note that was in tune and how it felt to sing a note that wasn't quite in tune. And you know, you learn how it feels to sing a fifth like against somebody. It's an amazing feeling, because it's such a, like, when you get it right, it's like a golden thing appears and you sort of feel this, and it's an amazing thing. And but I found this, you know, just by doing different songs alone, I think I got more of my harmony from listening to other things. I mean, I think it kind of depends how you practice. I'm not a religious practicer in any way at all. I find practicing kind of strange, but I do find fascination takes me to different places, and I really quest to understand things and put things into my own world of understanding. I was nested in sounds, and I was always encouraged to think about, I mean, I was always encouraged to think about everything in terms of it off, like emotion. So if there's like a vase or a bottle or a box on the table, and it was sort of pointing in a different direction, that would be sort of unfriendly or friendly. And or if you put something on it, they would be friends or they wouldn't be friends.
This is how you thought about spatial things.
Yeah,
about
spatial things. And same with sounds, you know, it'd be like a chord. And I think, well, you know, I'm always really mystified when people talk about major and minor in terms of happy and sad. I think that's very, very bizarre. I think it's such a weird thing. I think everything's about context, which is why if you look around, that's what it is. Like, everything's emotional. So a chord, just for what it is, can be unbelievably sad if it's major, but it can also be sort of like sad is such a bland, it's like saying something's black or something. Like there's no depth in the word sad, really. It's kind of like an open, it's like a doorway, and inside that there's all these different things that you can explore. And I was just encouraged to think about things, and definitely music, in this way. You know, anything I heard or anybody I met or anything I saw it from this point of view of just kind of being open to listening to it instead of imposing my own ideas on it. It just sort of think, well, what's that, you know, where's that, and what's it related to, and who are its friends, and, you know, it doesn't even have friends, you know, that's cool. And I think it's important maybe for people to think in terms of just the world as an emotional place. Because I think one thing that is shut down by education, I think, is connecting to things emotionally, I reckon. And so in that respect, I've sort of kind of been self-taught my whole life, just because things that I learn, I find them for myself. I find a place with them where I can, it has a root in something I understand, and then it will grow, or I plant a new root, but I make sure it's planted. It's not like a sort of superimposition of somebody's vibe and you have to just sort of eat it up, or else you know what I mean?
Back in Palm Springs, Ben was conducting investigations of his own. In the days leading up to his modernism show, he moved constantly between the piano and the computer, writing and rewriting, deciding which research to include in the program and which to abandon.
Okay, so I'm looking at your computer, I see all these files, and we haven't even gotten into most of them.
Oh, no.
What is the Fibonacci sperm egg?
That's very interesting, actually. Here's a fertilized egg. At the moment of fertilization, at the moment they just got this, the sperm hits the egg, the exact moment life begins, and it's mathematically perfect. And what they've discovered is that the biochemical wave that erupts across the egg's surface at the moment of fertilization is an instantaneous on-switch, a cascading molecular signal that transforms a dormant cell into the blueprint for life. And the patterns in the calcium are the Fibonacci sequence.
Hmm.
I thought, wow, okay. The Fibonacci sequence exists in sunflowers. It exists in seashells. You see it in Frank Lloyd Wright's design for the Guggenheim. That's all Fibonacci. But here it is, the moment that life begins.
One extrapolation is that beauty exists from the human point of view, that we recognize certain shapes, ratios, forms, and we say, that's beautiful, and it's not arbitrary. It's not even necessarily always subjective. It is actually burned into our own genetic code.
Yes.
And so we're in some way crafting the world around us to mimic the shape of our own code.
You know, it goes back to, do you get an idea and then the idea creates a feeling in you? Or do you have a feeling and the feeling generates the idea? And so epigenetics, right? That's the cultural transmission through DNA. There's a lot of information stored in our DNA, but is stored in our physical cells, that maybe the way they work is they turn certain things on and off, they act as switches, but they are part of our ability to understand. And it seems like there's a fundamental that's true throughout the universe based on harmonic ratios, based on vibration, based on proportions that I guess you could say we vibrate to. I mean, one of the things I love is that if you hit a piano string and it vibrates, and the vibration pushes the air into the world. Okay, now it's here in the world, but we don't hear it until it hits our ear and goes into our brain. There is no sound until it hits us. We create the sound. So just like we're sitting here, and there are trillions of vibrations all around us. There are microwaves, there's the Big Bang is humming out there somewhere. Infrared, we can't see it, we know it's there. All these waves that are here, we have no awareness of them. We're only able to perceive a tiny, tiny part of the spectrum of vibrations that make up everything. And that's one scale, that's one continuous arc from infrared to visible light to sound waves to whatever. That's a spectrum. They're not separate. They're not different things. When I started out to try to talk about this, I thought there would be a way to demonstrate it at the piano by talking about tension and release, 2-5-1. You're headed toward the one. You get there through the five, but you get to the five through the two because the two is the five of the five, et cetera, et cetera. So what this whole thing is a constant move toward resolution, like a tumbling sequence that ultimately lands, that there's resolution. And so I was able to compare it to storytelling. Storytelling is tension and resolution. That's why we're interested. And maybe I'm thinking that's why people are so narrative driven. At bottom, there's this dynamic, organic need for resolution that exists all the way at some basic level. That's what I was chasing.
Yeah. See, one thing that I think about when you talk about the need for resolution is that's convenient, but maybe not true, in the sense that the greatest stories told by humans are more complex than they are resolved. They leave you with a sense that nothing is ever entirely as it seems.
I totally agree, but it's still a process moving toward resolution. It's the search. And I don't think it's about the resolution so much as the movement.
Yeah.
I don't think it's so much about arriving at the answer or some resting spot. I think it's about the movement, and we're driven, that's the desire part, toward it. We're driven to tease it apart and try to understand. This is all just symbol systems that seduce us with the thought that we can understand what the story is.
All of this is heading towards, you agreed at the Palm Springs International Jazz Festival to put together some kind of a program on jazz and modernism, because it's modernism week in Palm Springs, and there's modernist architecture here.
It's the classic, what comes first, the words or the music? The gig.
Yeah.
Get the phone call. I got the gig on the basis of telling this story.
One possibility was that you come out and give a lecture.
Yeah.
And then a musical performance or some sort of a hybrid thing. Another was ignore that, all of this. Pretend you didn't say that. Just go out and give a concert.
Right.
You're
right.
A modernist guy. Right. It's modernism.
By definition, I'm modernist.
We're good.
Yeah.
And just do what you do, and people don't care.
Yeah.
And you have been like wrestling with this, to put the program together.
I don't think I've ever had a situation where for months I would wake up in the middle of the night and scribble things down on paper. I mean, writing books, I would do that here and there. But this has just gotten more and more nerve-wracking for me, because the information that I was gathering up all seemed to be leading somewhere. And you know, this is probably how all crazy obsessions start. They seem to be leading. I went to this lecture on modernism and magic, and he was talking about how magic is all based on expectation and opening up and close. I mean, sleight of hand, misdirection, and he connected it to modernism. And I thought, well, of course, you know, you could do modernism and corned beef. I mean, anything. If you're crazy enough to see it, it's there. Can you believe the amount of folders, files?
And this is going to be a 75-minute concert that you're going to give one time.
Yeah.
Painting with light versus sound. Starlings, thousands of starlings. These are just words I'm reading off of your, as you go, Fibonacci, Frank Gehry, Guggenheim, fertilized human embryos, chemical burst, DNA replication.
Transitions from a dormant cell into a developing organism.
The universal principles of self-organization seen across living systems.
Out of these interactions arise stable patterns, much like a sustained musical note formed by vibrating strings or air columns.
Right, so you basically prepared to do like a semester course. You started to treat this as if you were giving a series of master classes or symposiums.
I didn't realize it, but yeah. And I think the Taliesin experience was enough teaching experience for me to know that that doesn't work. You can't do it. And ultimately, how do you entertain people with hardcore information? That's what it came down to.
How is this different from the projects that you've done that have followed a somewhat similar formula in the past, like Lorca,
yeah,
or existentialism,
yeah,
or history of Jews and popular music in America?
Well, and all these things you're talking about are basically conversations about society, not science. So they were closer to storytelling and narrative, and I was able to see a plot. I'm trying to make a plot out of vibration. I'm trying to tell a story, and I'm digging deep into it, and what I'm finding is a mathematical language, and I suppose if I could speak mathematics, I could see the elegance in what I'm trying to get at, but I can't turn it into a story.
At one point, I recorded him reading through his script. By this point, he had distilled months of thinking into something more manageable, but still somehow kept quantum mechanics in his lecture.
Now, finally, there's this. It's about quantum mechanics. At the quantum scale, matter loses solidity. What appears to be solid resolves into a pattern of vibrations and rhythm. Particles are not like tiny billiard balls moving through empty space. They're excitations of underlying fields. They are vibrations. The universe at its foundation is not built on things, but on vibrations in the air all around us. Trillions of waves carrying meaning, but they don't mean anything without us perceiving them. What we touch, what we see, what we measure is the visible surface of an invisible ocean of vibration. Solidity is a performance. Stability is rhythm. Matter is music slowed down into form. There it is. Architecture is frozen music.
At the center of Ben's process is always the search for a narrative. For Ben, everything comes down to a story. After months of researching and reflecting, weeks of scripting and stressing, and days of showing me the folders on his computer, the moment finally arrived to take the stage. We walked out, we started swinging, and then he started talking.
Jazz and modernism, or architecture as frozen music. Frank Lloyd Wright did not say that, but he could have said that, because he talked a lot about the connection between music and design. And if you studied at his studio, you had to perform in the concerts they had every week for the apprentices. And if you didn't play an instrument, you had to learn how to play an instrument. Music was a requirement to be an architect with Frank Lloyd Wright. Why music? Because music is the mother tongue, the root of all languages, the grammar that we all understand, the source of harmony and balance, where the inside and the outside meet, where the light meets the dark, where all parts of the whole come together. Now, here in the desert, we think of modernism as the work of architects like Kreisel, Neutra, Wechsler, Frey, mass-produced art for the masses. But modernism itself actually came of age at the turn of the 20th century, 125 years ago. In America, it was called the Jazz Age. The Jazz Age. And jazz was a code word back then for having a good time. Not music. Jazz was something people did in the dark. But it was a new kind of life, out from under the covers of the Victorian age. Feeling of openness, optimism, confidence. Cubist painters, Braque, Picasso. They painted people with two noses over here, four eyes over there, taking it apart, putting it back together again in a new way. That's what modernism was. A shift in perspective. And this shift in perspective affected the people looking at the paintings, as well as it affected the paintings themselves. People were changed by modernism. The Roaring Twenties. Today seems pretty tame, but back then, with the flappers doing the Charleston in skimpy little dresses, they were writing pop songs like Everybody's Doing It, and nobody asked what doing it was. But this is how scared the authorities were of the future. In Chicago, the kids were going out and dancing to this new music called jazz in the clubs. And the authorities were concerned that this was going to get out of control. So what they did, this is so interesting, it's classic authoritarian, actually. They legislated that the tempos of the songs had to be reduced. So the kids started dancing the slow drag, and they were doing the bunny hug and the shimmy and clutching each other on the dance floor. The problem that they were concerned about only got worse. The kids were totally out of control. The problem was not the tempo of the music. It was the impulse of the people. Now, modernism has always flourished on the edges of where tradition meets chaos. World wars, economic disasters. Maybe it's the artist's response to healing to change the world. We try to bring order to the chaos through the arts, through painting, through music, through architecture. Now, the guiding principle of all these activities is putting the average person at the center of the art. Form follows function, as Louis Sullivan said. This search for harmony between men and nature, well, it's an essential part of music, and so music is an essential part of modernism. What does this feeling right here feel like? People always ask us, what are we doing up here playing jazz? Are we just doing anything? Well, yes and no. We're expressing feelings, but feelings are evanescent. They need an underlying structure to hang on. In music, there is an underlying structure. It's called the theory and function of tonal relations. And yes, this will be on the final exam. A linear logic is based on the architecture of harmony, how notes are in relationship with one another. It all comes down to vibrations, actually. Like the strings on this piano, they vibrate at specific frequencies. And these vibrations move the air. But it's not sound until the vibration hits our ears. It's simply vibrating air and doesn't become music until we hear it, until we perceive it.
Hearing brings the vibrations to life. People bring art to life. So we are the source of music. People are at the center of the modernist experience. Modernism is all about its effect on the people. Architecture, too, is based on vibrations, harmonic proportions. People bring it to life as well. A room is just a room until somebody walks in. In music, we compose through time, and architecture, we compose through space, but we use rhythm and harmony in both. In architecture, we see light, shadow, geometries. Buildings can have a melody. They call it the line. They have rhythm. Architects use open, repetitive riffs. Think of Kreisel's see-through cinder blocks. They're like beats in music. Harmonies in the shadows. Counter-rhythms in the shifting patterns and the movements of color. Tension and release, that's it. You see, that's the source of all storytelling, and the jazz is storytelling. And so is modernism. Where did Frank Gehry get the inspiration for his fantastical designs? From his grandmother. Check this out. When he was growing up and he was a little kid, his grandmother used to make gefilte fish. So she got fresh fish, carp, and she put them in the bathtub, and they'd be swimming around in the bathtub. And Frank Gehry was a little kid, and he saw them, and it really made an impression on him. So this childhood memory of those swimming fish lives on in the design of the Guggenheim at Bilbao. Finally, there's this. It's about quantum mechanics. Now, don't be afraid of the words. At the quantum scale, all the way down, matter loses solidity. What appears to be solid resolves into vibration and rhythm. Particles are not like tiny billiard balls moving through empty space. They're like excitations of underlying fields. They're made up of vibrations, like music. The universe at its foundation is not built from things, but from vibrations. They're in the air all around us, trillions and trillions of waves carrying meaning. But they don't mean anything without us perceiving them. What we touch, what we see, what we measure is the visible surface of an invisible ocean of vibration. Solidity is a performance. Stability is rhythm. Matter is music slowed down into form. Architecture is frozen music.
The next day, Ben and I met in the hot tub to talk about the experience.
Thank you.
He was relieved. He was happy. And he seemed especially pleased that he had managed to work the gefilte fish story into the routine.
So you walked off stage.
I was pretty close to blithering. I didn't know what had just happened, really. It was such a survival game that I was, you know, psychologically kind of recovering from treading water. Kind of what it felt like doing it. I mean, we had done great prep, man, I have to say. When I got into some of the rough spots, I knew that just on the other side was a note I could hit. And so I held on, and it was really like a jungle gym, arm over arm, going through this stuff, but the audience reaction was so positive. It's, in the last 24 hours, refocused me on how much people want context, real world context for what's going on today. And most pop culture doesn't give them anything. And a lot of jazz is a lot of jazz. But what we're doing up there is a kind of cabaret show, with you and I kind of being a comedy element, and me talking about how this is going to be on the exam, and the intellectualizing, but at the same time, you got the gefilte fish story, and you got a bunch of... So it's this package that delivers jazz in a real contextual way. And it's deceptive, because we're really not talking about jazz. We're talking about everything around jazz. And I've been trying to develop that for a long time, and this was really hard, but it turned out that's what it was about.
When you look at your script, what you distilled it down to,
yeah,
was it 10% of what you initially thought you were going to talk about?
Maybe 50%. I threw out all the statistical stuff, and I threw out anything that was too far out philosophically or verbally, you know, or if it was too repetitive, or if it got too deep into the difference between vibration and harmonics, or, you know, I mean, people, it turned out, didn't need that at all. And I focused on stuff that was a story, storytelling. What would be funny for people to hear? Oh, and when you suggested break down right after everybody's doing it, bap, nobody asked what it was. That's kind of a little shift, a move, when you pick up the groove, when you play the stuff. It was deceptively...
Yeah, those little shifts in texture and dynamics make it feel intentional, and they make it feel orchestrated. Why do you think this one was giving you so much trouble?
Number one, not my natural ballywick. Modernism, architecture, I've done some thinking about it, but...
Oh, you know, you were saying how you saw a magic show and it was all sleight of hand.
Yeah.
See, I think what you do is the same thing. It is that. It is all sleight of hand. And there's a couple things that you managed to achieve. I've always said you give people a sense that they are smart enough to follow along.
Yeah.
So they feel smarter when they leave. Because you present it in a way that, whatever the material is, Lorca, Camus, Frank Lloyd Wright, the experience of Jews in America, in a frame that they can get with, anyone can follow. That is a sleight of hand. It's a sleight of hand, I think, that is performed by most great teachers.
Right.
And not only do you understand, but you're excited to understand it, excited to know it.
Yes.
The other thing is, yes, you use playing jazz piano as a sort of Trojan horse.
Exactly.
And so that's a magic trick also.
Yeah. I had backed myself into some kind of a psychological corner about the complexity of the issue. And,
yeah,
you know, and in reality, it turned out it wasn't complex at all. It was just a story. It was a story about a boy. If you wanted to work with Frank Lloyd Wright, you better play music.
Yeah.
You know? And even the architects in the house were going, oh, I didn't know that. Is that true?
That speaks to a larger question also. People who have access to such big ideas and can sort of see the matrix so clearly, like he could, and he had his ideas that were so influential, also tend to be very quirky on a personal level.
Miles Davis.
Yeah. And then you might find yourself confusing their personal quirks with the ideas that they have and asking if they're related in some way.
It is such an ongoing matter of confusion how God has bestowed certain talents on people who are, if you look at their lives, least likely. I mean, I always said in jazz, the people who sound the most beautiful on their horns could often be the most violent junkies, and there was no connection to the beauty,
right,
that they were in control of, to the ugliness that they weren't in control of.
Most of the projects that you've done in the past that were like this were
organized around personal experiences rather than ideas.
And
so that's interesting. That's one of the ways to sneak the ideas in, was to sneak it in through the story.
Through the story of the guy. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a much easier storytelling platform than tell the story of an idea.
Are you encouraged after this that you have not lost your edge to the extent that you feared that you had?
Let me tell you something. I'm not as fast as I used to be. But at 82 years old, to walk up there, project confidence and comfort, to improvise, to tell a story, to laugh to the jokes without having to set them up. To be there, to be in that space, knowing that I've got some pitfalls that didn't used to be there, and being able to negotiate them. That was very interesting, because I think that was part of the terror, man. I didn't know about that. I didn't know. Ultimately, you know, it's the age of organ recitals. Everybody I know has got something. It's pretty hard not to wonder what we're waiting for you.
The age of organ recitals, wow, man. Also interesting that improvising does not scare you. It's preparing that scares you.
I thought about that.
The reason I think it was so good for you to do it from behind the piano, and I think it is really important that you do that when you can, is that nobody can. It's kind of amazing to be a guy who, it's one of one.
I've always said, talking is the same thing as playing. Feels the same to me.
Watching my father go through this experience was one in a long line of projects I've seen him prepare. But this one did feel a little different. There was a kind of existential urgency to it that past projects hadn't quite had. At times, it felt like he was fighting for his life as he tried to assemble these ideas, which may explain why he chose to play his tribute to the existentialist philosopher Albert Camus and the myth of Sisyphus in the middle of a concert about modernist architecture. Ben likes to say that Sisyphus, the Greek mythological figure who was condemned to push a rock up a hill for eternity, was lucky because he had a gig.
And we're all suffering. Why are we all suffering? What is that about? Why do we come into the world and go out of the world suffering? Basically, this is why you need jazz musicians, because they can explain this to you. The thing about suffering, it can be elusive. The man pushing the rock up the hill, Camus said, you have to picture him happy. Suffering is happiness. Without adversity, there's no growth. And without growth, you're doomed to misery. So in your suffering is the potential for happiness. Now, a jazz musician would say, well, look, he's pushing a rock up a hill. At least he's got a gig.
What I witnessed in Palm Springs last month was the slow process of trying to translate intuition into language, the unrelenting task of pushing a rock up a hill.
We all existentialists.
And ultimately, after diving deep into the mysteries of the natural world, looking for some kind of source code, the story my father discovered in his search was his own. Maybe the goal was not to solve the mystery. Maybe the point was simply to keep searching for the clues, because as long as he's searching, it means he's got a gig. Beneath the architecture, beneath the music, beneath the stories we tell about them, there's something more fundamental. The patterns, the ratios, the vibrations, the invisible structures that shape how the world moves. Every once in a while, you tap in and you hear them. And if you're lucky, someone calls you with an assignment, and the muse shows up for work. The Third Story is produced and hosted by me, Leo Sidran. We're made in partnership with WBGO. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more of their award-winning programming. You can also read what I'm writing at leosidran.substack.com. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Consider leaving a review. I'll be back again in your headspace with another deep dive before you know it.
You'll see another man, another rock, going up another hill.
Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.